You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 26th of July, 2013, on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House here on Monocle 24, live from Studio One here in London with me, Emma Nelson and Tyler Brulé.
Egypt faces a day of mass protests after military leader General Abdel Fattah Sisi called for the nation to rally against terrorism. We'll have analysis from the studio here in London and our colleagues in Cairo.
The Muslim Brotherhood were no less brash, responding with announcements that they too would hold marches the very same day, setting up a potential confrontation between the two sides that could exacerbate the violence that has swept up the country.
More from Abdulrahman Hussein in just a few moments' time. Plus, we reflect on how good design can withstand even the coldest conditions and provide a nice environment too in the Antarctic.
I suppose it wasn't overt, but there was definitely a desire to make a statement of the place of British science in the Antarctic, which is to a degree reflected in the design.
Sorry, plus in a preview of this week's menu, Emma Nelson, not you, we sample the simple treats on offer at Seoul's Bear Restaurant, run by Buddhist monks.
At first, when we opened, our customers were only monks or other Buddhists who came here to eat. But as we became better known, I started noticing people from other religious backgrounds coming in. Just because it's Buddhist cuisine doesn't mean only Buddhists can enjoy it.
All that, plus we set the day's agenda with journalist and author Rachel Shabby. We review the news from China and we play some of our own music too. And we might even learn to read a script. That's all to come in the next hour here on Midori House. First, though, let's catch up on the latest world news with Paul Osborne.
Monocle 24 News. The United Nations says it's troubled by Australia's new policy on asylum seekers. It plans to send all people arriving by boat and claiming asylum to Papua New Guinea. But the UN High Commission for Refugees says it's worried about significant shortcomings in the legal system there. Thousands of asylum seekers try to reach Australia by boat every year. And political commentator in the country, Bernard Keane, told us there's little sympathy for them among some voters.
There is a grim political reality here, which is that there is no real downside to being seen to be too hard on asylum seekers just because of the electoral dynamic.
Egypt's army has warned it's prepared to use force if protest rallies in the country planned for today turn violent. Supporters and opponents of the ousted President Mohamed Morsi plan to stage demonstrations later. It's now more than 3 weeks since he was forced from office. The UN has demanded Mr. Morsi's release. Tunisia's largest union has called a general strike after the killing of the country's opposition leader. Mohamed Brahmi is the second politician to be shot dead in the country this year. Last night, protesters took to the streets demanding the government step down, something the Prime Minister had warned would create a power vacuum. Youssef Sherif is a Tunisian political commentator.
General strikes in Tunisia mean also street demonstrations. So let's expect dozens of thousands in the streets of Tunisia. The main streets of the main cities will be packed with people. There will be calls for the government to resign. There will be calls for the president to resign.
The U.S. company Halliburton is to admit destroying evidence over the oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico 3 years ago. The spill at BP's Macondo well was the worst in U.S. history. It followed an explosion at the Deepwater Horizon oil rig that killed 11 workers. BP had accused Halliburton of destroying evidence. The company's admission means it will have to pay the maximum possible fine of $200,000. A crowd of around 1 million has greeted Pope Francis at Brazil's famous Copacabana beach. He was there for the formal ceremony of World Youth Day, telling the pilgrims to stir things up. After visiting a sprawling favela, the Pope also said that no one could ignore the deep inequalities in the world. A review of Japan's defences says the country needs better marine forces and should introduce surveillance drones. The report highlights concerns about rising tension in North Korea and disputes with China over islands in the East China Sea. On Wednesday, Japan scrambled fighter jets after a Chinese plane flew close to the islands. Four campgrounds in the U.S. state of California have been shut down after officials confirmed a squirrel found in a national park was infected with plague. Although the disease no longer presents a significant threat to human health, sites in the Angeles National Park have been isolated. People living nearby say otherwise it could easily spread.
I want to advise everybody to make sure they don't bring their pets. I know that it's important for the kids to come camping, but to be sure to bring the proper insect repellent.
I always see squirrels and chipmunks up here when I come up here during the day, so it's good they know about it.
That's the latest news on Monocle 24.
Thanks very much for that, Paul. Emma, I'm so lucky that I didn't know that before I ran around the park this morning. I mean, who knows what's happening, 400 metres from here in Regent's Park?
How did they know that the squirrel had plague? Did it have a little bell around its neck?
Well, I'm more sort of intrigued by the whole reference of sort of insect repellent. What are you going to do, spray the thing in the face?
Oncoming
squirrel.
Spray a squirrel with mace, that's the way to do it.
We're gonna pull it back together here, aren't we?
I hope so. We've got just under 54 minutes to get ourselves
to redeem
one
ourselves.
You've been for a run around the park.
I have.
That's turbocharged you.
It has.
Beware, everybody.
Exactly. It's 1906 you're listening in Auckland. It's 1606 in Tokyo, 806 here in London.
London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24. London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24. London, New York, Tokyo. This is Monocle 24.
Thanks for that, Kylie. You're listening to Midori House live from Studio One here in London with me, Tyler Brulé and Emma Nelson. Well, time now to set the day's agenda with the three big stories in one part of the world you'll need to know about over the next 24 hours at least. Joining us now is Rachel Shavi, author of Not the Enemy, Israel's Jews from Arab Lands, journalist focusing on all things Middle East related. Very nice to see you in such a short span of time. Last time, I think there was an Aperol Spritz in your hand.
Earlier
in the week. Yeah, I think so.
Are we going to give that away?
We won't. We don't need to. I didn't see it. It was a blur.
Yes. And why was it such a blur for you?
You were a blur of polka dots. You were sort of navy and white polka dots. It was very nice.
Very good recall for detail.
Not bad, right?
Tyler.
On my fourth Aperol Spritz at that time. But as Emma predicted, I've had my run this morning, so I'm super hyper.
So you're turbocharged.
Yeah.
It's terrifying.
We're going to be talking, of course, in considerable detail, at least in this first half hour, about Egypt. Do you want to start on Egypt, Rachel, or Israel-Palestine? Where do you want to go?
Shall we start with Egypt, since that's the story that everybody's looking at with some concern this morning? Obviously, big protests, big rallies on the streets expected this morning after the Army General al-Sisi asked protesters to rally to the streets today to give him legitimacy in his fight against what he calls violence and terrorism, which people are seeing as code for the Muslim Brotherhood, who of course have been protesting the eviction of former President Mohamed Morsi, who they see as undemocratically deposed by military coup. So and they have actually called for a jihad in response to Sisi's calls for a rally. So a lot of tension could unravel there on the streets of Egypt today. We're watching very carefully to see what actually takes place.
What's astonished me is the speed with which the rhetoric has been ramped up in the last couple of days. You had Abdel Fattah al-Sisi's comments, which were immediately countered by the Muslim Brotherhood, saying, you know, we must protest as well. There was absolutely no conciliatory talk at all.
It's an indication of how entrenched the situation has become, but it's also quite astonishing how fast the Egyptian public seems willing to play along with the army's rhetoric about the Muslim Brotherhood being a terrorist group. I mean, this is going back to sort of pre-Mubarak era rhetoric about the Muslim Brotherhood, who, as we know, have been persecuted and outlawed and imprisoned for most of their existence. And it's incredible that how the rhetoric has rapidly reverted back to those days, with the population seemingly happy with that.
How much do you think, I wouldn't call it posturing or window dressing, when they're talking, you know, about a day to stamp out anything that, you know, looks vaguely like terrorism, and this sort of whole notion of jihadism? How much is this all to also just quell Western governments and governments in the region as well, to put people's minds at rest, if you can, to say, well, we sort of have a hand on things, or is it really purely domestic focused at this point? I mean, if you're sitting in that leadership position or semi-leadership position right now in Cairo.
It's interesting. I mean, I think you're right that to a certain extent, I mean, they do have an eye on Western opinion. Clearly, the Egyptian army is bankrolled by the US to the tune of $1.6 billion in military aid that goes directly to the army in exchange for preserving geopolitical peace, the Cold Peace Treaty with Egypt and general stability in that area. So, of course, the army will have an eye on that. The US just announced a few days ago that it will not go ahead with its plans to send new F-16 fighter jets to Egypt, and the army will be feeling that keenly as well. But at the same time, I do think it is a bit of a domestic, you know, it's a grudge match. It's been historical between the army and the Muslim Brotherhood. They have been at loggerheads for decades with various kind of unholy alliances in the last 2 years. But it does seem as though the army is determined to eliminate the Muslim Brotherhood as a political force, and it has a population that it is testing to see whether it's willing to back that up or not.
I know you wanted to talk about Israel-Palestine in just a few moments, because that's all starting next week, but let's stay in a sort of the first example of contagion from Egypt, perhaps. Tunisia, but the opposition party leader, Mohamed Brahmi, has been assassinated. That is profoundly destabilising, isn't it?
Completely destabilising. And of course, it comes just 6 months after another vocal opposition figure, Shokri Belaid, was assassinated in very similar circumstances. Both men basically gunned down by armed men on motorbikes outside their homes. Very shocking for Tunisia, not a country that is in any way used to this level of political violence, to assassinations on the street. This will be a really deep shock for Tunisia, as was the murder of Shokri Belaid, a murder that still has not been accounted for. And it will be a very testing time now for the coalition, which is led by the Islamist party, Ennahda, to just keep it together and to stop the situation spiraling, or sort of this sort of domino effect where it is in some way inspired by the situation in Egypt to try and in some way replicate that and evict the Islamist-led government.
I mean, if you're sitting in Tunis, it's one thing to maybe look, you know, left and right, east and west, at your neighbors, where maybe they're a little bit more limbered up for unrest, and you almost have to sort of, you know, get into that type of rhythm. But you know, this is, as you're saying, this is so new for Tunis. How do you think they're going to cope with this?
It will be a real test of the coalition, I think. I mean, the population will be deeply upset and shocked. We can expect mass protests on the streets today. The major union has called for a general strike, and a general strike in Tunisia will mean protests on the streets. It will be a real challenge for the coalition, for the Ennahda-led coalition, to not allow this situation to escalate into an Egypt-like situation. And it will only be able to do that, I think, by showing the kind of cooperation and consensus building and national unity that the Muslim Brotherhood spectacularly failed to do while it was in office, which is part of the reason why people became so opposed and disappointed with it. So the way to avoid that is to seek the consensus that as we can see, Egypt is so lacking at the moment.
Rachel, let's move on to talks, quite unprecedented talks perhaps, that could be taking place in Washington next week between the Israelis and the Palestinians. How surprised is everybody that people will be coming to the table?
Well, I don't know about unprecedented. I mean, we've had 20 years of what I'm now insisting on referring to as zombie peace talks, because obviously it's like resurrecting the undead. They go nowhere. It's kind of like just talks for the sake of having talks. I'm not sure that anybody seriously expects them to lead to anything significant, because clearly they have not done in the past.
And this is perhaps why I said they are unprecedented, because people are saying, why are you bothering? Is it a sort, almost a show of neither side can be seen to be withdrawing from the table?
I think that's definitely a part of it. I mean, Israel and the US have more interest in this sort of show of something taking place on the diplomatic process. Israel is trying to fend off other means of challenging its occupation. We've seen the EU escalate its guidelines with a sort of tough stance on funding of settlements. It has said that it wants attempts to change the labelling of Israeli products so that settlement goods are clearly identified by next year. So Israel is very keen to deflect and de-escalate that level of international pressure. And it sees a way of doing that as moving into this sort of diplomatic process, which historically has not really cost Israel anything. If anything, it has cost the Palestinians much more. I mean, settlement expansion has been driven in the periods during which there have been peace talks.
Rachel, I just want to pick up just before we go on the notion of show. If you're John Kerry, if you're the Secretary of State, would you have chosen maybe another premier act than this? To of course bring everyone to Washington. We just did a peace course. You know, the Norwegians are brokering a deal, obviously, with the government in Bogota and FARC. Potentially more interesting and more headline grabbing. What do you make of that, just from a political observer perspective?
This is very useful for the U.S. In the U.S. mindset. I mean, as far
that they
as
can just rally these people, come to D.C. and.
Come to DC. We're the broker. We have some significance in the Middle East over perhaps the most important significant issue in the Middle East, and we need to be seen to be doing something about that so that we don't lose our significance and status in that region. I would expect that those are factors that motivate John Kerry, not to diminish from the man. I mean, by all accounts, he's very principled and has all the right intentions, but you have to wonder whether those good intentions are a little bit misplaced and. In this particular conflict.
Journalist Rachel Shabi, thanks very much for joining us. Have a very good weekend.
Thank you, you too.
Coming up on Midori House, we head to Cairo ahead of today's nationwide protests.
Who's that big, handsome thing getting all the looks on the beach, attracting envious glances by the pool and too many amorous advances in the sun-dappled cafe? That's right, it's Monocle Mediterraneo, a big, bold, large-format newspaper that reports from the sunnier southern European spots each summer. Our editors have been scouring ports on the rise and plage for pleasure to bring you a host of reads to enjoy with your Aperol this vacation season.
In the design section, we kick back in two stunning holiday residences, a mid-century gem on the volcanic island of Pantelleria and a beautifully crafted fortress in the Atlas Mountains. We also go on an architour around the Sarrià Sangiovese district of Barcelona and uncover some beautifully intact post-war designs.
In the edit section, we relax and take a break by the beach while we await our food and drink to be served, courtesy of four Mediterranean chefs, including the number one chef in the world. And to keep in shape, we travel to the surf towns of Eritrea, Sesme and Batroun to catch a few waves and a bit of sunshine too.
Make sure you get your copy of Monocle Mediterraneo. It's on newsstands now, or order a copy from monocle.com. You'll be the envy of all the lounger lizards.
You're back with Midori House, where the time here in London is 18 minutes past 8 in the morning. Now, earlier this week, the head of Egypt's military urged supporters of the army to demonstrate after Friday prayers to show their allegiance. The call was immediately condemned by the recently ousted Muslim Brotherhood, who claimed that the army was inciting civil war. Instead of calling for calm, the Brotherhood urged its supporters to protest too.
And in turn, the army has responded by saying it will use force to crack down on any so-called terrorists. It is not a recipe for peace on the streets. Some protesters have already said they'll carry medical supplies with them. In a moment, we'll hear from our Rebecca Collard, who's in Cairo, but first a report from Abdul Rahman Hussein.
Egypt is bracing itself for yet another round of protests, but this time it comes wrapped in tensions and a foreboding of violence, after Egypt's army leader called on people to march to offer him a mandate to combat what he termed terrorism. Amidst the depolarization Egypt has seen since the ouster of the president, Mohamed Morsi, earlier this month, Minister of Defense Abdel Fattah al-Sisi called on Egyptians to take to the streets Friday to give him this mandate. The Muslim Brotherhood were no less brash, responding with announcements that they too would hold marches the very same day, setting up a potential confrontation between the two sides that could exacerbate the violence that has swept up the country. Over 80 have died in the weeks following Morsi's removal by the military. El-Sisi may have resorted to this in the wake of an explosion outside a police station in the governorate of Mansoura and continued violence in the Sinai Peninsula, but the army is accused of its own massacre after 51 Morsi supporters were killed at a protest outside the Republican Guard's premises in Cairo. Other clashes have erupted between pro-Morsi protesters and local residents of the areas in which their citizens are located. Morsi's ouster came in the wake of the biggest protest Egypt has seen since the onset of the 2011 revolt, but since the coup of July 3rd, matters have taken a worrying turn. Egged on by an extremely partisan media, a rising xenophobic rhetoric has emerged which has seen foreigners treated with suspicion, and often much worse. Syrian refugees have borne the brunt of this because of baseless rumors that they are supporting the Muslim Brotherhood cause in words and deeds. The Muslim Brotherhood have fared no better, reverting to increasing sectarian rhetoric in which they speak, again baselessly, of the role of Egypt's Christian population in their downfall. The one thing both sides have in common is an increased mistrust of the US role in proceedings, with each side claiming the US favors the other. All this is the powder keg backdrop of Friday's proposed demonstrations, a still divided Egypt that may yet yield more violence.
Abdel Rahman Hussein reporting there. Rebecca Collard is in Cairo. I should also say that we've managed to detain Rachel Shabi. We didn't let her out of the studio. She's also going to be weighing in on this discussion now. But first to Cairo. Good morning, Rebecca.
Good morning.
Maybe just tell us from your vantage point, wherever that may be, just the feeling and mood on the street in Cairo this morning.
Well, this morning, of course, it's before Friday prayers, so things are very calm. There's nobody out. But in the even last night, you could see tanks parked outside Tahrir Square. Definitely people preparing for these mass rallies today. So definitely a tense atmosphere, and also an atmosphere where people feel like they're going to have to come to the street today to show what they support in the country.
Rebecca, in the past, when we have seen widespread protests across Egypt, there has always ostensibly been a peaceful approach, no matter how ugly the protests turned later. With this, do you think that there is a slight change of tone in here? The army is clearly saying that it is prepared to use violence. Muslim Brotherhood protesters are saying that they are already taking out syringes and bandages. Are people just gearing up for conflict?
Well, I think that today, during the day, we'll see slightly peaceful protests. You know, these are the sort of protests where we're going to see kind of families and this sort of thing, especially because we're going to have separate camps. So we're going to have those who are backing the army in one place and those that are backing the Mohamed Morsi, the ousted president, and the Muslim Brotherhood in another place. But I think as maybe in the evening and in the coming days, we are going to see some violence. Of course, I mean, the slight irony is that General Sisi is calling for kind of mass rallies against violence and terrorism. And it almost sounds ironic when he says it, that you're going to hold mass rallies, because, I mean, bringing thousands of people to the street, as we've seen before in Egypt, isn't likely to end peacefully. You're right.
Rachel Sharby, you were shaking your head when you heard that from Rebecca.
Well, no, I mean, I think we all hope that the situation is going to remain peaceful today. Of course we do. But the trouble is that the kind of rhetoric that we've seen, irresponsible rhetoric from the army and from the Muslim Brotherhood, that creates its own momentum of escalation and makes it all the more likely that conflict is likely to take place on the streets. And of course, from the Muslim Brotherhood's perspective, what have they actually got to lose at the moment? Their deposed president is detained. Nobody knows where he is. Over 50 Muslim Brotherhood supporters were, as they see it, massacred in the last few weeks. Their TV channels and media have been shut down. More and more of them are being arrested. They don't see a political way out of this situation. So what other way out is there except for them to remain in the streets? So by that logic, we have a very terrifying, potentially, situation on the streets there. Where we could see a very ugly showdown between the army and the Muslim Brotherhood, albeit that we all pray that that won't happen today.
Rebecca, I just wanted to pick up on that as well. Just, you know, the curbing or shutdown of various media outlets. I mean, can you see any, you know, direct impact? I'm wondering how much that also then splinters the Brotherhood on the street.
As far as splintering the Brotherhood on the street, I don't know if it has, if you mean by having a divisive effect in the movement, I don't necessarily think so. But definitely, I think there's this, as Rachel was saying, the shutdown of the kind of, I guess, I don't know if we're going to call them the opposition media now, the Brotherhood media, of course, is having an effect. And I think there's definitely a general feeling that the media that is still operating in Egypt definitely is in support of the army and kind of rallying support for the army. And I don't think that that's a hard thing to do either. Egyptians, I think we've seen since since the army first came to the street, you know, 2.5 years ago, Egyptians do have a kind of affection for their army. So, so definitely the media is continuing to support that here, but I also don't think it's a hard to kind of rally support.
Rebecca Collard in Cairo, many thanks for your time, and also our thanks to Rachel Shabby, the journalist, who's kindly stayed on to talk to us about that. We'll be covering any developments from the protests in Egypt as the day unfolds, so do stay tuned here on Monocle 24.
From London
to New York
to Tokyo
to Shanghai
to Berlin
to Tel Aviv
to Buenos Aires
to Toronto,
to Amsterdam.
All around the world, this is Monocle 24.
And you're listening to Midori House with me, Tyler Brulé and Emma Nelson. It's it's 1925 if you're in Wellington, 1625 in Sapporo. It's 1525 in Shanghai, where we head now for the next round of the day's news with our contributor and correspondent there, Emily Ford. Hello, Emily.
Hi, Tyler. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. Should we start with Beaujolais? That seems to be sort of leading the news, anything coming out of China at the moment, but also the whole GlaxoSmithKline story as well. And of course, you know, what that means for big Western pharmas as well in China, also an interesting story. I will let you choose between the two. Where do you want to start?
Well, I think it has to be Beaujolais. GSK is a very big story. But the announcement of the trial of Beaujolais is something that, you know, everybody's been waiting for with bated breath for you know, more than a year now. And after months of official silence, we've finally had the announcement that the trial is going to be held probably within the next month in the city of Jinan in Shandong province. So this has been pretty big news here.
It's an example of the Chinese trying to mete out justice and ensuring that justice is being seen to be done. One news agency reported that his arrest and his charging proves the point that everybody is equal under Chinese law. That isn't quite the case, though, is it?
No, absolutely not. I mean, I think there's definitely a sense that, you know, they are making an example of Beaujolais. Xi Jinping, the president, has made it clear that he's nobody is too big to be brought down, you know, for corruption, and that definitely applies in the case of Beaujolais. Having said that, the charges that are being leveled against him, bribery, embezzlement, abuse of power, they're very serious, but they're not necessarily as serious as they could have been, which suggests that there's been some deal-making going on in the background here, and that some of Beaujolais' supporters may have called for, you know, succeeded in slightly lesser charges. So I think he's unlikely to get the death sentence. He's probably facing a long prison sentence.
Why don't we pick up, Emily, on the GSK, the GlaxoSmithKline story. So, you know, here we have, you know, what looks like one of the biggest anti-corruption investigations in China. You know, there are now indications that another major pharma is also being pulled into this, AstraZeneca. How much, I guess, first, is this a contained domestic story? You're talking about, of course, you know, the most recognizable, you know, multinationals in the pharma world. But is this a contained China story, or does this investigation start to, you know, head all the way back to head office, do you think, as well?
I think that's a really interesting question. I mean, Sir Andrew Whitty, GSK's chief executive, has made it very clear that head office knew nothing about this. They're trying to paint it as a very Chinese domestic scandal that some local executives got out of line. I mean, I can't comment on whether the activities that have been taking place do go further, but certainly in China, it looks like this was a very big problem indeed. And I think the feeling seems to be that it's definitely going to extend beyond GSK to possibly AstraZeneca and other big pharmaceutical multinationals with operations in China.
The fact, Emily, that it seemed to be so widespread, and how receptive do you think that the Chinese medical industry itself was receptive to bribery?
I mean, the healthcare sector is notoriously corrupt here. Everybody from, you know, doctors to hospital administrators, are frankly known to be taking bribes, and in the past few weeks many doctors have admitted it. The machine wise that they found 1,000 doctors in one city guilty of corruption. And part of the reason is that their salaries are extremely low. Their fixed salaries are extremely low, but also just an endemic culture of taking bribes. It's just the way that business has been done here. And so experts say that, you know, almost every company is likely to have at some point been involved in corruption, anyone working in the healthcare industry here.
Emily in Shanghai, thank you very much indeed for joining us.
And coming up in the next half hour of the program, we reflect on Arctic architecture being celebrated by the British Council and head to South Korea to sample the delights of a Buddhist eatery in Seoul.
At first, when we opened, our customers were only monks or other Buddhists who came here to eat. But as we became better known, I started noticing people from other religious backgrounds coming in. Just because it's Buddhist cuisine doesn't mean only Buddhists can enjoy it.
All that to come in the next half hour of today's programme. But first, with the time just approaching 31 minutes past the hour, here's Paul with the headlines.
Egypt's army has said it's prepared to use force if necessary if protest rallies in the country planned for today turn violent. Supporters of the ousted President Mohamed Morsi plan to stage demonstrations after Friday prayers. The head of Egypt's army has also called for those who oppose Mr. Morsi to show their support for the military. The United Nations says it's troubled by Australia's new policy on asylum seekers. It plans to send all those arriving by boat and claiming asylum to Papua New Guinea, but the UN High Commission for Refugees says it's worried there are significant shortcomings in the country's legal system. Tunisia's largest union has called a general strike after the killing of the country's opposition leader. Mohamed Brahmi is the second politician to be shot dead in the country this year. Last night, protesters took to the streets demanding the government step down. The US company Halliburton's to admit destroying evidence over an oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico 3 years ago. It was the worst in US history and followed the explosion on the Deepwater Horizon oil rig that killed 11 workers. By admitting destroying evidence, Halliburton now faces a fine of $200,000. And a review of Japan's defences says the country needs better marine forces and should introduce surveillance drones. The report highlights concerns about disputes with China over islands in the East China Sea. Earlier this week, Japan scrambled fighter jets after a Chinese plane flew close by. And those are the latest headlines on Monocle 24.
Thanks very much for that, Paul. Emma, I'm disappointed that there was no updates on the rabbit squirrel story.
I suspect everybody's fleeing.
Yeah, exactly.
Terrified.
Masses
of mass. They're all gone to go and get their mace.
Yeah, World War Z exodus out of Los Angeles right now. In case you missed it, you're listening to Midori House. You're on Monocle 24, and you're with me, Tyler Brulé, and Emma Nelson. And also, as you might have noticed, South Korean cuisine has recently been gaining a little bit more attention, at least on the global palate. No wonder the ubiquitous side dish kimchi has been recognized as one of the world's healthiest foods. Up for debate, I would say.
It's
anyway,
a bite too far for me, I must confess.
Korean-style barbecues are popular in Koreatowns in many countries and certainly far beyond. And there's been a lot of buzz about Korean-Mexican fusion taco trucks in Los Angeles. I'm waiting for one to pull up outside right now.
I don't even want to think about it. However, back in South Korea, some restaurateurs are taking the national cuisine back to its spiritual roots. Bear is a restaurant in Seoul that's run by an order of Buddhist monks. It's been written up in various guidebooks and food blogs as one of the best places for vegetarian dishes in the city. Now, vegetarian food is not something our man in Seoul, Jason Strother, normally sets out for, but we sent him along nonetheless to Bear for this week's edition of the menu.
South Korea could be considered a meat lover's paradise. Barbecue restaurants with all sorts of cuts of pork and steak are everywhere, but there are certain places where meat is not on the menu. Buddhist temples. The Choge Temple in central Seoul belongs to one of Korea's oldest Buddhist sects. For centuries, the Choge monks have grown their own vegetables for their daily meals, but their cuisine isn't confined to countryside temples any longer. In 2009, the order opened the restaurant Baru. It's not in the Choge Temple, it's just across the street in a very modern-looking building. I took the elevator up to the fifth floor. That's where I met Baru's manager, Moon Myung. In true Korean fashion, we sat around a table on the floor of the restaurant to talk about what Buddhists eat.
We were one of the first restaurants in the country to focus on Buddhist cuisine, and it also helps that we were located just across the street from the Jogye Temple. The cuisine here is the same kind of food that the monks make at their temples. At first, all the food was grown on Jiri Mountain, in the south. But as this restaurant has gotten bigger, we can't just get the vegetables from the mountain alone. So we buy from local markets. Everything is grown here in Korea.
Moon assures me that one does not actually need to be Buddhist to enjoy temple food.
At first, when we opened, our customers were only monks or other Buddhists who came here to eat. But as we became better known, I started noticing people from other religious backgrounds coming in. I noticed this because some would pray before they started eating. Just because it's Buddhist cuisine doesn't mean only Buddhists can enjoy it. We welcome everyone from whatever background.
When I think about what temple food might be, I picture men in gray robes eating out of small wooden bowls with chopsticks. It doesn't strike me as high-end eating. Moon says that in order to attract Seoul's urban dwellers, the cuisine did have to go through some cosmetic changes.
Well, the food presentation isn't exactly like how the monks would eat it out in their temples. It looks a little more plain out there. But since we are in the city and we are quite a popular restaurant, we do dress up the food and make it more presentable looking. Likewise, we wanted to make the interior design of the restaurant not exactly like a temple, but at least reflect the peacefulness of being in a temple.
Well, there are at least pictures of Buddhist temples adorning the walls of Baru. But enough about decor, let's open the menu. Baru offers course sets. They all have names like Path to Nirvana and Dharma Principles. Enlightenment is a 15-part meal that includes brown rice porridge, bean stir fry, wild root salad, a vegetable pancake, and tofu-filled dumplings, just to name a few. It costs about $50, certainly not temple prices. Since I don't think I'd be able to handle a full course set, Miss Moon suggests I give a dish called yunnipap a try. She brings me back into Baru's kitchen to see how this and all other dishes are made. Back here, Chef Han Jun-yeol gives me the tour. There's a station for handling cold foods, a pancake frying station, the vegetable cutting table, and a giant cauldron for boiling noodles in the summer and soup in the winter. Chef Han has been with Baru for 2 years. He used to work in normal Korean restaurants until monks taught him how to make temple food. He says it's a really different atmosphere here.
I think it all has to do with the food. Food is peaceful, and I think it affects the atmosphere in the kitchen. It's very calm here.
Miss Moon recommended yunnipap for us. Could you explain what that is?
Yunnipap is sticky, glutinous rice, cabbage, chestnuts, pine nuts, red dates, ginkgo nuts, and black wild sesame wrapped in a lotus leaf. First, we steam just the rice 2 times. Then we wrap it in the leaf with the ingredients and steam it again.
I head back to my table just ahead of one of Baru's waitresses who's rolling a cart stacked with dishes, including my yunnipap. Placed down on the table first are several side dishes, which include seaweed, a bowl of doenjang, a zesty miso soup, and of course, kimchi. I'm sure no one wants to hear me eat, so mic off. But I turned it back on for manager Moon Mi-young. Speaking as a true omnivore, I ask her how, with all of these other meaty eating options in Seoul, can Baru attract customers? She says despite the popularity of barbecue restaurants, South Koreans are becoming more conscious about what they eat.
Koreans these days are really concerned with eating healthy, and Buddhist cuisine is a good option. And I see this kind of food becoming more trendy. We have already opened our second location, and we run a smaller version of this restaurant on the second floor for businessmen who have to eat and leave quickly. And some of our customers who live in the south of Seoul and in the suburbs are complaining that we're too far away from them. So we are thinking about opening another branch in the Gangnam area someday.
Do you think there is a spiritual element to Korean Buddhist cuisine? Is there any certain philosophy or special way that this food is made?
I wouldn't go as far to say that the food here is spiritually healthy, but it certainly can help you to feel more relaxed or calm. It affects your mood and mind. It's healthy, everything is natural, no artificial ingredients. I think that you can really feel the purity and peacefulness that goes into our food.
Peaceful, yes, but there's no guarantee that Baru's temple cuisine will actually lead you to enlightenment. For Monocle in Seoul, I'm Jason Strother.
Jason Strother eating well there. You can hear more treats from this week's edition of The Menu at 1900 hours London time here on Monocle 24.
And I sort of, should we have qualified in the lead into that package that the restaurant's Bear, B-A-R-E, not B-A-R, B-E-A-R. Lots of connotations that go along with that. You're listening to The Midori House. We'll be back in a moment to see how good design and architecture can withstand even the coldest of environments. We're heading to the Antarctic next.
Election Day in Zimbabwe is almost upon us. 5 years since the historic power-sharing deal between President Robert Mugabe and opposition leader Morgan Tsvangirai, Monocle 24 assesses how the political landscape's changed since Election Day 2008 and what's at stake for the country and the continent in this year's vote. From the economy to the arts to freedom of speech, we'll unpick the key issues at play as Zimbabweans head to the polls. Zimbabwe Votes, a series of special reports, all next week, here on Monocle 24.
And you're listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Well, should you be of a scientific disposition and have the inclination to head south, and I mean really south, to Antarctica, you may be pleasantly surprised by some of the living arrangements on offer. That is, if you manage to bag one of the research stations exhibited by the British Council's Ice Lab, New Architecture and Science in Antarctica.
From Belgium's zero emission station to the 134 prefabricated shipping containers that make up India's, to three other contributions from the United Kingdom, Korea and Denmark, the designs try to reflect how innovative contemporary architecture can make scientists a happy to live and work in one of the most extreme environments on our planet.
And one man never afraid to don his crampons and thermals is our David Pleasant, who went to the exhibition in Glasgow, I believe it's just yesterday, before it kicks off on an international tour. He joins us in the studio. Good morning, David.
Good morning, Tyler.
So tell us, it's interesting when you think of this as a concept. I guess I wanted to know, you know, where the starting point for the idea was. Because when you think of Arctic stations or Antarctic stations, they've probably written or at least been the starting point for so many movie scripts. I can't think of how many sort of, you know, B-grade, attempted A-grade thrillers have been set in this environment. So did the curators of this, did they think that this was, you know, a good starting point because it would really capture the imagination of Joe the punter, you know, the average Republican who would maybe not normally go to an architecture exhibition?
I think so. There's a bit of that. But as soon as you get to the exhibition, you realise that the design and it's had a very kind of careful approach to putting together these different stations and their stories. It's not a populist exhibition in any way. It feels quite geeky. It feels like, you know, the materials that they've chosen to use, the whole thing is kind of draped in green felt, and they've even developed their own kind of Antarctic font. It's not as corny as
what
it
does
sounds.
That look like?
Chilly.
It looks a bit like kind of Martian script. I can't quite, but it's very tasteful. I'm underselling it, I think. They've actually done a very good job. It's not as gimmicky as it might sound.
So tell us a little bit about these exhibitions. We have different countries coming, offering different solutions to living in one of the coldest places you can think of. How much was each country thinking about, you know, not only the practicalities of trying to keep people alive and happy to work, but how much of a quality of life element was introduced into this?
Well, I think that's the key thing, Emma, because I think over the decades that different countries, different teams have been in the Antarctic, very little attention has been paid to the comfort, to how the scientists actually live. And that theme was very present. I mean, if I talk about the Indian Bharati station, that, as you mentioned, was made out of former shipping containers, although you wouldn't tell it from the exterior. It's a beautifully designed station designed by Architekten IMS of Germany. Inside, they have a kind of 1970s style lounge with leather armchairs. It feels like a club club class lounge from, you know, 1972. It's really, it's kind of really, really special environment.
You can't readily change the decor, however, can you? Come in and just feel like repainting.
No.
Tell me, how much of when you toured and did the preview, was there also a sense of you know my base station is better than yours, and how much of is there a sort of a soft cold power play going on in Antarctica?
I think that's the core issue, and it's probably why this exhibition is coming about, and good on the British Council for being first to get there. But obviously, we have South Korea, we have the Indians who've always had a presence. We've even got the Belgians who, although are kind of fulfilling an obligation under the EU to invest in Antarctic research, they've really gone all out for it and have this beautiful Princess Elizabeth Antarctic Research Station, which is the most eco-friendly, but also, I would say, the most beautiful. It's a wonderful shape on a ridge, one of the few kind of exposed bits of rock in the landscape. It's there looking out over the landscape.
Big kitchen for cooking mule frit as well, maybe.
Let's hope so.
You don't need a freezer, that's for sure. I mean, when it comes to actually building these things, I mean, is there any kind of engineering or infrastructure precedent? Because you can't, you know, who do you hire to go and build your station? And was there any indication of how these things would actually be done?
Well, I think it's all about the isolation, and it can only be done over a very short period of the year. So the whole thing is quite slow. But it is quite an amazing process. But you really wouldn't tell it. I think there's been a great advancement in terms of these stations. I'd like to visit them one day.
Mm, well, be careful what you wish for. You had a chance to talk to architect Hugh Broughton. What was his pitch to you when you were chatting to him?
He was probably the British Halley 4 station was probably the most kind of remarkable or in this new generation. And we're going to hear him talk about how he feels and how British it made him feel.
Let's have a listen.
Antarctica is a very curious place because on the one hand, each of the stations is an embodiment of the scientific aspirations of that country. But then at the same time, it's a place of extraordinary collaboration. So people help each other to levels that perhaps they wouldn't do in the normal world. But, you know, Britain has a big part to play in the Antarctic, and Halley is a flagship project. And I suppose it wasn't overt, but there was definitely a desire to make a statement of the place of British science in the Antarctic, which is to a degree reflected in the design.
Do you think there is some of that, if we look at some of the other stations, whether it's India, Belgium, South Korea, do you think there's a bit of kind of archy diplomacy going on in the Antarctic? If there is, you've taken part in that. Do you think that's happening?
To a degree, we have certainly had a lot of discussion with, for example, the Germans who built a station recently, with the French as well, and with the Americans. And there's a lot of help that's gone backwards and forwards between the nations, people talking about what systems worked, what cladding types worked, and so on. But one of the great things about this exhibition that I think will come out over time is the opportunities to talk to some of the designers of some of the stations which are featured here, the Korean station, the Belgian station, and the Indian station, which was designed by a German team. And I'm really looking forward to meeting the designers of all those stations and having a good chinwag about problems that they had to face.
So it's really becoming a little community of Antarctic architects, a very select few. I mean, are you working on other similar projects? I mean, there has been one at the Spanish station, is that right? And do you see kind of a whole line of these kind of projects in the future for your practice, for your career?
While we were designing Halley 6, we entered another competition for the Spanish station, which we won, and that's now under construction. It's finished on the outside. And then more recently, we won another competition for a laboratory for the American National Science Foundation. In this case, it's in the Arctic, in the summit of the Greenland ice cap. We've been asked to look at designs for other countries as well. In fact, in the competition which Space Architecture won for the Korean station, we also took part in that, and also for the Indian station. So it's nice to see the two winners here today. It's a limited market, I guess, but once you have some expertise, it's a great place to be.
And that was architect Hugh Broughton at the Ice Lab New Architecture and Science in Antarctica competition, talking to our David Pleasant. Just David, very, very quickly, that sort of whistling sound in the background, was that the dreadful weather of Glasgow, or do they actually sort of pipe in like live feed from outside a station somewhere?
It's the sound of the Antarctic. There's these strange scientific noises that are apparently very present if you're on an Antarctic station.
And finally, just before we go, if we potentially decided to set up a bureau in Antarctica, which station would you be voting for?
I would go for the Belgians.
All right, there you go. All those
fair enough.
Not the Koreans. Anyway, we're not going to go quite as far right now, at least not to the bottom polar ice cap, but we are going to go to New Zealand. I think it's to Christchurch, to the suburbs. This is Funk Community with Pass It On. And that was Funk Community with Pass It On here on Monocle 24. This is Midori House with Tyler Brulé and Emma Nelson. Who's in the studio, Emma, other than you and me, of course?
We have our news editor, Tom Edwards, who has brought down and has covered the broadcasting table with newspaper.
There are plenty of newspapers.
It's great. We can have some sort of like child play later if you wish.
Exactly.
It's all beautifully covered.
Exactly. Yeah, there's plenty of newspapers. I mean, obviously, after a big story like this, we've seen the Spanish rail crash. I think it's interesting to just look at the kind of overview across Europe and see how people cover it. Generally fairly similar. We mentioned just looking at the pictures, obviously it's quite arresting that there's been this pictures of frame by frame of the accident unfolding, and I think newspapers have largely decided to put that on their front pages. There's also some really dreadful, I mean very moving pictures of people learning the fates of their loved ones. There's pictures of really extraordinary pictures of the accident scene, this scene of devastation, and most of the newspapers are now focusing, as indeed the Inquiry is doing, on the driver. He's under scrutiny. It does appear that it's a case of simple human error. And I guess the questions that are being asked now is, how is it possible with so much at stake that
to be going over double the speed limit on what was everyone, you know, certainly working for Renfe and the rail operators in Spain, that this was already known to be a tricky corner. You're going at you know, double the speed. And I'm looking at the cover of El País, of course, the major Spanish daily, which of course, again, has a frame by frame shot of you see the train, you know, barreling to the corner and just, yeah, the you know, the back wheels of the engine just going off, and then of course it then, you know, careening and piling into the guard walls beside, and then a very sobering image of a couple in tears on the bottom of the page.
That's right. I mean, I was talking to Tristan McAllister, our transport editor, last night about how most of these high-speed rail systems should have, governors and limiters that check in automatically. And of course, people will naturally start asking the question of why, whether they were in place, and if they were, why they weren't working.
But and it's quite a blow for Spain, I would say, from a global positioning sense. Here's a country which is already having a very tough time of it, but so many people pointed to the fact that they got away with it in a very good way, that they spent all this money on infrastructure, of course, before the economy properly tanked, and this was really an area of expertise that they built up. And so, you know, Spain has been hoping to, of course, sell their rail systems to other countries, just as the Germans and the Chinese and the Japanese have been doing.
Renfe do actually go around the world advising other countries on how to install, safe and high speed rail systems. What I find appalling, though, is the ghoulish nature of the publication of this picture of this image of the train coming around the corner. As soon as you hear about it, I immediately leapt on my computer and wanted to see it happen. And then you have this awful thing that you want to replay it, and at one point the replay becomes so ubiquitous that it kind of loses its impact again. And looking at the front cover of the Times, it just seems to be almost gratuitous. Whereas if you look at the picture of the Daily Telegraph, or in fact Le Monde, their images show a much more human element. And I wonder, what a news editor's choice is. Will we go for the drama of the crash, or in fact the aftermath? It sort of is very telling about what news editors think about covering news.
Absolutely. I guess maybe one of the key drivers there is just scarcity. I mean, it's so unusual to have images of an incident of this type. Unfortunately, I think that's probably what sort of swung it in that direction for many of them. But, I mean, there's an interesting piece in The Independent in London today of their travel correspondent, Simon Calder, talking exactly, Tyler, as you were saying, about the advances that Spain made. Because if you think back, even during the 1980s, I mean, Spain had it antiquated. It was one of the most outmoded train networks, certainly in Europe. And they've really moved on, and they've had huge investment. It's been very successful. So it'll be interesting to see how, you know, the country responds to this sort of problem.
I wonder, Tyler, what this is going to do for the European image of rail, given the fact that there was a crash in France 2 weeks ago in which 6 people died.
I think enormous question marks, and certainly there are a number of big rail contracts on the horizon. So Vietnam, Brazil, Thailand at the moment, extension of rail networks in Taiwan as well. And we've seen it's the Spanish, the Germans, the French, Japanese, and the Chinese who are all lining up. So you do wonder. When you, in some cases, it's very, unilateral. Sometimes it's closed bidding. You don't know. But I would not be surprised if some of the major conglomerates from Europe get kicked out of the running. I just want to pick up on the Financial Times, and this is maybe a story for, it's a Friday story for the summer. Jonathan Mills writes a story about it pays to give the boss a break.
I omitted that story, actually.
I'm just back from holiday, so it's fine. But it is interesting talking about how it is gaining currency, and maybe the Nordic approach of taking a full month off and really disconnecting is happening, and so it gives some pointers. Have someone else step into their job during their sabbatical. This is a chance
that
for fresh
like
eyes.
I
think so as well. The person should completely disconnect. No checking email. No calls.
Is that possible?
I'm not sure if that's any way to run a business. At least if it's if you're on the hook as an independent.
If everybody else is off, that's fine.
It is, and I think that's why it works for Nordic countries. I think that's why all of Italy can go away, and elsewhere. One more story. Can you do it in less than 35 seconds? Ten seconds.
Can we do the plinth?
Well, let's do the fourth plinth very quickly. The fourth plinth in Trafalgar Square in London, we know that it has a rolling sort of programme of different installations. And there's no other way of saying it. They've got a blue cockerel on there now. Boris Johnson's tried to upstage the arrival of the big cock, making lots of jokes about it, suggesting it's because Britain's triumphing in the Tour de France. But that's my favourite.
If there's any time for a sound effect, it was now. Today's show is produced by Fernando Augusto Pacheco. Our producers, Alan John and Chris Fitch behind the desk. It's goodbye from me, Tyler Brulé.
And from me, Emma Nelson. Goodbye and thanks for listening.
A Rolex timepiece represents an ongoing commitment to innovation, horological expertise, and the passion of skilled watchmakers. All add up to make the one principle by which Rolex lives, that greatness is a journey that never ends. Rolex.